His topic today is an intriguing one. God and Caesar, Rome and Washington, compatible couple or odd couple? Please welcome the Most Reverend John L. May.
Thank you, Dr. Barth. Thank you all, dear sisters, brothers, all in our Lord. It is my great joy to have some small part in the sesquicentennial of this blessed and beautiful place, which has meant so much to the life of this community and far beyond it to our country. I would certainly second what Dr. Barth has said about the cooperation, especially in recent years, between this institution and the church which I serve. I am grateful for the opportunity to bring personal congratulations and esteem to you and this anniversary, and also those of the Catholic community here in St. Louis. We are all in your debt. It is my hope that the dialogue we'll have after this formal presentation will be the most fruitful part of what we do here this afternoon. Accordingly, I will try to leave plenty of time for that. And as you can see, this topic lends itself to a wide-ranging spectrum of questions and observations, and so I hope it will be that case also this afternoon. You probably have wondered many times about the Catholic Church, but you were always too polite to ask. We won't be polite today. We'll be open to any questions. Governor Cuomo, Mayor Shamo, or anywhere you want to go. I appreciate the opportunity to address the topic of the Christian politician in this ecumenical setting, precisely because of the ecumenical nature of this symposium. I wish to indicate at the outset how I plan to proceed. While the assigned topic is the Christian politician, my remarks will be developed in terms of Roman Catholic theology and experience. But I believe this will provide the foundation for application in other ecclesial communities. The objective is to locate the discussion of the Christian politician within the context of an analysis of the role of the church in the political order. And so, I will touch on three themes. First, the church in the political order according to Vatican Council II. Second, the church in the political process in the United States. Third, the Christian in political life. First, the church in the political order according to Vatican Council II. This is the 25th anniversary of Vatican II's document, Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world. This text, the last and the longest of the conciliar documents, was the surprise of Vatican II. The council was an ecclesiological council dedicated to the study of the church. But in the planning for Vatican II, there was no specific design to have a document on the church in the world. It was the experience of the conciliar debate among the bishops which convinced them of the need for a document which would go beyond the internal life of the church and address systematically the relationship of the church and the political, economic, cultural, and international order. It is this range of issues which Gaudium et Spes examines. In terms of the political order, the conciliar text responds to three questions: why the church is interested in the political order, how it should relate to the political order, what it seeks to achieve in this relationship. The why question is fundamental. It establishes the foundation and rationale of the church's relationship to the world generally and to the political order specifically. In paragraph 76 of Gaudium et Spes, the church is described as, quote, a sign and a safeguard of the transcendence of the human person, close quote. This description of the role the church plays in the political order also provides the basic rationale of the church's work in the social ministry as a whole. The church enters the arena of debate and decision making about politics, economics, law, and social policies because of what it believes about the dignity of the human person. The religious conviction about human dignity is rooted deeply in the biblical tradition. The creation account found in Genesis poetically describes the creation of man and woman as the pinnacle of God's creative work. Only they are in the image of God. The rest of creation reflects the glory of God, but the human person replicates the divine image. The Genesis text is brought to fulfillment in the event of the incarnation. The God who made us like unto him at the dawn of creation chose in the fullness of time to make himself like unto us in the incarnation. The creation incarnation accounts surround the human person with unique value and dignity. The created order exists for benefit of the person, each person, and all people. Human stewardship of creation is exercised through politics, economics, science, and social policy. The church cannot be indifferent to how issues are defined and decided in these forums. How is the church to enter the arena of politics, law, the economy, and social issues? Gaudium et Spes addresses this question in two steps. On the one hand, the conciliar text asserts that Christ gave his church no proper mission in the political, economic, or social order. The purpose which he set before her is a religious one. Paragraph 42. On the other hand, the Vatican Council calls the church to fulfill its religious ministry in such a way that it contributes to four secular goals: the defense of human dignity, the promotion of human rights, the fostering of a sense of unity in the human family, and the provision of a sense of meaning to all areas of human activity. To summarize the conciliar argument about how the church relates to the political order, I would say it calls the church to be faithful to its religious origins and destiny. The church is called to be an instrument of the kingdom in history. It cannot exhaust its vocation in the temporal political order. Its ultimate goal must be beyond history in the coming of the Lord's kingdom. But neither the religious origin of the church nor its ultimate goal should keep it from contributing to the shaping of a just and peaceful civil society, to work for the protection of human dignity and the fulfillment of human rights is something which falls properly within the church's religious nature and ministry. It is also bound to be a significant contribution to the public and political life of a society. What form will this contribution take? This is the third theme one finds in the conciliar document. The council describes a process of dialogue between the church and world, in which the church learns from the world and also has something to teach the world, the good news. The church's contribution through this teaching ministry is to act as, quote, a sacrament of unity in the midst of society, a transforming presence which stands for and with the human person and helps society to judge its performance not only in material terms of wealth created, goods produced, power exercised, inventions discovered, but also to judge in light of how rights and duties are protected and related, how the weak and vulnerable are included in the life of society, and how the forces of technological change should be directed to the good of the human family. So much for background. Second section, the church in the political process, the U.S. experience. The impact of Gaudium et Spes has been felt throughout the universal church. If one examines the role of the Catholic Church in situations as diverse as Brazil and Poland, Chile and the Philippines, South Africa, South Korea, it is impossible to account for the degree of church involvement in issues of peace, human rights, and social justice on an ad hoc or a random basis. The scope of the involvement, its frequency and its intensity, all point toward a more systematic explanation of the rising significance of social ministry after Vatican Council II. The content and the influence of the council provides, I believe, the best single reason to account for the social shift of Catholicism in the last 25 years. In the United States, the influence of Gaudium et Spes could be analyzed at several levels of the church's life. Perhaps the most visible forms of social engagement in the 1980s were the activities of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. During the last decade, the bishops were participants in four major social controversies. The four issues were U.S. nuclear policy, the abortion question, U.S. policy in Central America, and the justice of the U.S. economic system. All four of the issues were intensely contested social and political questions. The bishops sought to assess them from a religious and a moral perspective. Rather than analyze the specific moral positions taken by the Episcopal Conference, I wish to focus on the ecclesiological issues which arose in light of the public role the bishops assumed. On each of the four issues cited above, The bishops not only had to propose and defend a specific position, they also had to explain to their own congregations and others how they understood their religious and civic responsibilities in the public arena. A summary of how the Catholic Church sees its role in the political process can be grasped by examining three questions: constitutional, theological, and pastoral. The constitutional question is usually asked in terms of the First Amendment. Does an activist religious organization violate the American understanding of church and state? In my view, the political meaning of the First Amendment is that religious institutions should expect neither discrimination nor favoritism from the state in the exercise of their civic and religious rights and duties. If this accurately portrays the political intent of the amendment, Catholic teaching on church and state will agree in both principle and practice. Acceptance of this interpretation of the church-state relationship would not have been so clear-cut prior to the Second Vatican Council. The conception of church-state relations in possession in much of Catholic teaching up until the 1950s was that of the normative position called, quote, the Catholic state, close quote, while other constitutional arrangements like the one in the United States could be tolerated but not necessarily approved in principle. The Council's Declaration on Religious Liberty in 1965 displaced the notion of the Catholic state with a conception of church-state relations based on three principles. The first was the acceptance of religious pluralism as the expected condition within which the church would pursue its ministry. Pluralism was neither to be resisted nor repressed. Within the framework of religious pluralism, the right of every person to religious freedom was affirmed as a demand of the natural law and the gospel. The second principle was the acknowledgement of the secularity of the state. The state envisioned in the conciliar text is not the Catholic state of the post-Reformation era, but the constitutional state whose powers are limited by law. The third principle was the freedom of the church. It affirms that the church seeks only one objective from the state, the freedom to function and to fulfill its ministry. Pluralism, secularity, and freedom. These three ideas make it possible for the church to maintain its independence of the state, to affirm the state's limited but essential role in society, and to endorse a constitutional order which protects and fosters religious liberty for individuals and communities. At the same time, the acceptance of the separation of church and state embodied in the American constitutional system does not extend to a separation of the church from the society. The Catholic theologian, philosopher John Courtney Murray used the liberal distinction of state and society as part of the argument he made prior to and during Vatican Council II to overturn the normative status of the Catholic state. It was the great American contribution to that World Council to accept the separation of the church from the state does not mean accepting a passive or marginal status for the church in society. The church-state question governs the juridical relationship of these two institutions. It does not control the activity of the church in the wider fabric of society. In summary, the Catholic Church finds the American constitutional framework in accord with its contemporary Catholic teaching. The teaching endorses the independence of church and state, sees the church's principal forum of witness in the wider society, and accepts as a social, not theological, description of the church, that of a voluntary association with a specific capability to assess social policy and issues in light of religious values and moral principles. Now, the theological question is how the church understands and establishes the basis for its social ministry, its participation in the public life of society. As I have indicated earlier, in Catholic teaching, the foundation of the social ministry is its religious conviction about the dignity of the human person. The decisive contribution of Vatican II to the social ministry of the church was to locate defense of the person, and by extension, the protection and the promotion of human rights at the center of the church's life and work. By focusing on the person as the link between the church's moral convictions and the political order, the council provided the church with a method of public advocacy which protects its religious character, but also provided a field for significant social engagement. The style of the church's engagement in the political arena is, quote, indirect, close quote. Since the church has no specifically political charism, its proper competence is to address the moral and religious significance of political questions. This indirect address to political issues also sets limits on the means the church should use in pursuing its four designated goals. Means which are expected and legitimate for properly political entities are not necessarily legitimate for the church. The casuistry of keeping the church's engagement in the political order indirect involves an endless series of choices and distinctions. But the effort must be made, precisely because the alternatives to an indirect engagement are equally unacceptable. Either a politicized church or a church in retreat from human affairs. The first erodes the transcendence of the gospel. The second betrays the incarnational dimension of Christian faith. The Catholic Church is engaged in the public arena on the basis of this, quote, activist, close quote, but indirect understanding of its public ministry. The pastoral question concerns how the church should fulfill this indirect role. The church has three principal assets to use in the public or political arena: ideas, institutions, and a constituency. To participate in the public arena of a complex, bureaucratic democracy like the United States, these three resources are necessary. The ideas represent a systematic tradition of reflection about the relationship of religious values and moral principles to social institutions and public policy. The institutions provide a means of projecting ideas and positions into the public dialogue. Institutions, social and educational, allow the church to match its words with deeds. They also allow the church to be present where the public contending on issues takes place, from hospitals to shelters for the homeless, from parishes to universities, from schools to legislatures. The constituency of the church, its membership, taken as a whole, is the pivotal element in the church's presence in society. The
quote, power, close quote, of religious organizations lies significantly in their capacity to share a vision, a set of values, and a perspective on personal and public life with their members. The United States Catholic Bishops' two pastoral letters on peace and the economy were designed to relate ideas, institutions, and constituency. By projecting ideas into the public arena, by articulating a framework for assessing social policy, and by encouraging reflection and debate within the community of the church, the pastoral letters were one way for a religious community to contribute to the religion, morality, and politics debate. The experience was an attempt to speak to both the ecclesial and civil communities simultaneously. The pastoral letters, therefore, provoked a double debate. The principles and the policy conclusions were discussed widely in the secular, academic, and public and policy communities. Within the church, the same discussion took place, but it had this added note of conscience and authority themes. The link between the two arenas of discourse is the fact that the shaping of a consensus within the church is a key test of how religious communities witness in the public arena. At the intersection of these two debates, within the church and within the society, lies the vocation, the role, and the significance of the Christian politician. And that will be my third topic and final one, the Christian politician. My purpose thus far has been to locate a consideration of the Christian politician within the broader topic of the church's role in the political order. By the church, I mean the institution and the community of the church. The Christian politician is a member of the community of the church. As such, he or she does not speak for the church as an institution, but I would stress that the most important form of ecclesial presence in the political order is the community represented by Christians as citizens and as public officials. The institution exists to teach and preach the essence of the gospel and its social significance. It exists to assist the formation of the mature Christian conscience on issues of personal and social morality, and to help the community read the signs of the times and relate them to the vision of the scriptures and the social teaching. While I believe that the active public involvement of the bishops in the 1980s is something we should continue on a broad range of social issues, I see this institutional witness as a means of catalyzing and supporting the public engagement of the Catholic community as a whole. Public involvement requires public servants, individuals who are committed to serve the public life of the nation as elected and or appointed officials. In Gaudium and et Spes, specific attention is given to this vocation. The church regards as worthy of praise and consideration the work of those who, as a service to others, dedicate themselves to the welfare of the state and undertake the burdens of this task. Paragraph 75. This formal endorsement of the Christian politician's role needs to be reinforced today in the United States. The reason for this is the prevailing pessimism about the state of governance in the nation, an attitude which seems to be reflected nationally and locally. Less than a month ago, the Sunday edition of the New York Times had a lead story entitled, quote, America's Politics Loses Way as its vision changes the world. Close quote. The opening paragraph read, "As America's democratic visions and values seem to triumph around the world, an unhappy consensus has emerged at home that domestic politics has become so shallow, mean, and even meaningless that it is failing to produce the ideas and leadership needed to guide the United States in a rapidly changing world." The article complemented the striking cover story of Time magazine last October entitled, "Is Government Dead?" Again, the lead paragraph asserted, quote, "Unwilling to lead, politicians are letting America slip into paralysis," close quote. These articles raise large and complex questions about the quality and character of leadership in our land. I do not propose to address the range of issues needed to respond to these questions. Instead, I will confine myself to two themes drawn from Catholic theology. First, the positive role of the state in society. Second, the irreplaceable role of the political vocation. The articles cited are not simply critical of politicians. They are asking about the public's confidence in the role of government. Catholic teaching does not see the state as the answer to all of society's problems, but it does expect the state to be a positive moral and social force, precisely because persons are social beings, requiring a social setting to achieve human fulfillment. Government in society should not be seen in negative terms. The idea sometimes heard in our midst that the proper role of government is to staff the police force and to defend the nation is an entirely inadequate description of the role which political authority should play in society. Catholic teaching espouses the principle of subsidiarity, which favors several centers of power and creative activity in society. But even in the framework of subsidiarity, we should recognize that essential public needs will go unmet if we espouse the view that, quote, government is the problem, close quote. I am not prepared to develop a catalog of appropriate tasks for federal, state, and local government, but I do want to recall the role which defines the state's purpose. It is to serve the common good by protecting and promoting public order in society. The need of the moment, I believe, is renewed public argument about the content of this common good and the demands of public order. It is clear, I believe, that without an active, engaged role for the government, a series of basic social needs will go unfulfilled in our society. These include education, health care, and housing. My point is not to say the answer to all these questions is simply more money, but money is part of it. A nation which cuts the federal housing budget by 70%, as we have, cannot be surprised by pervasive homelessness in the society. Providing minimal levels of health care for the 37 million Americans now without insurance will require a creative role for the state and federal government. Money is not enough. The pessimism about governance has as much to do with ideas as it does with resources. To break the gridlock of governance, evident today at several levels of our society, will require an infusion of ideas, resources, and personal leadership. This last item returns the discussion to the Christian politician. My second theme in these closing comments. I have placed primary emphasis on the problem of governance, because I do not want my remarks interpreted as a critique of individuals holding public office. My experience has yielded a positive impression of people willing to enter the political arena. I wish to stress the irreplaceable role of the political vocation to urge others to consider it. I think part of the problem with governance today is that in our educational and religious institutions, we may not challenge people to public service. The call needs to be made in terms of an invitation and a challenge. An invitation to men and women to consider a public life lived for the common good. And a challenge to see the public life as a vocation, a way of doing the work of the kingdom and of civil society. I believe we should expect much of public figures, political and religious, and we should promise them support when they are willing to make difficult choices. It is this spirit, a public which sets high standards for political leadership and which cultivates support for the political vocation, which I believe we need to cultivate. We need a public dialogue of conscience and conviction about a series of major questions facing the nation: the deficit and taxes, the poverty of women and children in our midst, housing and health care, the United States' role in addressing the distinct but urgent human needs of Central America, Central Europe, Central Africa. Part of our crisis of governance is a creeping paralysis of the spirit. We tell ourselves we can't do more. We can't stretch our vision and our policies. And soon we believe this narrowly defined conception of our public life. We need a public dialogue to stretch our sense of the possible for this nation in the next 10 years. Part of that dialogue of church, society, and public officials needs to be about the abortion question. My purpose is not to launch into a discussion of this specific issue at this late point in the lecture. It is rather to put the dialogue of bishops, people, and politicians on this question in the same framework as the other issues I have already mentioned. As you know, the Catholic bishops specifically focused on the responsibility of political figures at our meeting in November. I believe it is correct to address public officials as part of our wider societal dialogue on this fundamental life and death question of abortion. But I am sure we should address the general public and politicians as teachers seeking to engage, to persuade, to convince by wisdom and insight. It is a dialogue of conscience we need on this question, not a debate about using ecclesiastical discipline or penalties. The abortion issue needs to be cast as the fundamental moral issue it is for our society, not as an authority struggle within the church. On abortion, housing, health care, taxes, and foreign assistance, we need a 1990s debate focused on how these specific policy choices ultimately shape a deeper option about the kind of society and country we are. The church's relationship to the political order and the role of Christian politicians should both be directed to providing a generous, compassionate response to the societal question of who we are. Finally, I've noticed that it is very proper here to quote from distinguished Lutheran voices. So I would like to do that. In 1987, at the University of Notre Dame, one such voice said, The marriage of politics and religion does not result in an easy relationship, and it is one that both the political and the religious community must approach with care. The United States has emerged with a working relationship between the religious sphere and the political, each influencing the other, but with neither playing a dominant role in the life of the other. This has proved to be healthy, both for religion and for government. But we did not reach this point easily, and we will not proceed from here with ease. There are bumps in the road ahead, and people will shout advice at each junction on the road. So spoke one who has been quoted before today, Senator Paul Simon of Illinois. I hope this afternoon we have not joined in that non-harmonious chorus at the side of the road mentioned by Senator Simon. Thank you.
Archbishop May has opened up for us a wide vista for our questioning and discussion. We invite your comments at this time. Please.
I'd like to speak in regards to public housing and providing more. I have never lived in a new house in my life. The house I'm living in now is 50 years old. I have a brother in about the same shape. And we, like tens or hundreds of thousands of other middle-class taxpayers in this city and in this nation, have provided brand new homes for so-called underprivileged people. We've never felt that we could afford a brand new home. And these brand new homes for underprivileged people were reduced to slums, and some of them, like Pruitt-Igoe, were blasted into rubble because they could not rehabilitate them. We got two housing projects in the city of St. Louis right now that the housing authority wants to eliminate. One has space for approximately 1,000 families and the other for 465, I believe. And the two of them together only housing approximately 500 families. So there's about 1,000 vacant units there. Among middle class people, we feel that we have provided housing for the unfortunate, and they have not taken care of it. 50 years ago, when President Roosevelt was in office, he set as a goal to eliminate the slums and provide decent housing for every American citizen. And for 50 years, the federal government's been in the housing business, and instead of eliminating slums, it has become the biggest owner of slum property in the country. So many of us in the middle class, working class field, don't think that the government should do more for these so-called underprivileged people when we can't afford new houses. We feel, many of us, that there's been a lack of concern about the middle-class people, and if you keep having these increased government programs with increased taxes, you will pull us down into the poverty-stricken where we'll have to go to the government for a handout. And we'd like to see a different approach to this instead of the government throwing more money at these problems that have been a failure for 50 years, and they end up being the biggest owner of slum property in the nation. The government is not the solution to the housing project.
Thank you. The government is certainly not the ultimate or whole solution to the housing problem, but we can't leave the responsibility of government for that area of the common good out. the poor management, the neglect, the terrible waste of public housing as exemplified in your remarks in this city are indeed a scandal. And it's a scandal which has its roots very deep in this community, in our society, in the people that are put into those places and the way those places are managed. And I agree with you, it's been a waste. At the same time, the government cannot now wash its hands and say, we tried that. The government has a great responsibility, has a great responsibility for its waste. Thank you. Yes?
Pastor Berger.
In the political and economic arena, I'll say I find myself much more often in agreement with such Catholic writers as Michael Novak than I do the pastorals of the U.S. bishops. Is there any significant forum among the U.S. bishops for dissenters such as he? And for that matter, is there any amount of such dissent within the bishops themselves?
Michael Novak was part of the group that was consulted in the writing of both pastorals. He didn't like the consensus that developed, and he wrote his own. That's, of course, his right. Within the bishops themselves, the statement on peace was voted overwhelmingly with, I think, seven negative votes out of 280, I believe. There is no meaningful group dissenting from that document, and the one on the economy was the same. The next one will be the one on women in church and society, and that one will probably have a little greater division.
Sir, in the Catholic Church and other American denominations where there's a stress on social and economic justice, have you seen this go hand in hand with the spreading of the gospel, or has the stress on social justice take precedence over the proclamation of the gospel?
The purpose of that work, obviously, is what I indicated and tried to indicate in what I said, that certainly that is the role of the church, primarily, is the good news, is to bring in to our society as much as possible the values of the gospel, the kingdom. And we believe it goes hand in hand. I don't think you can ever separate the two. And I believe that on the record, there has been great, great accomplishment for both.
Mr. Bartel.
Yeah, maybe this dovetails right into that. You went from Genesis 1 to John 1, treading lightly on Genesis 3, and certainly the fallenness of the whole order out there is a major complication in all of this. I'm struggling toward your definition of the kingdom of God. I'm not asking you to respond to whether you find a Lutheran distinction of two kingdoms relatively strange or not, though if you wish to comment on that, it would be of interest. But let me phrase my specific question this way. Do you feel is it theoretically possible for a non-Christian, through the use of his role in the state, to further the goals of the kingdom of God?
Yes, at the oversimplification of being too brief, that's usually not my problem, but I would say that I do find the concept, the Lutheran concept of the two kingdoms, as theologically strange. We do not believe in that dichotomy in our sense. And of course, this is a different tradition. In ours, there is the one kingdom in which the gospel plays its role and in which all of society and all of its needs and so on are part. And it is all one incarnational role in which we are situation in which we work, and it must be so. Was there a final question? I think that's...
You want to follow up?
Well, yeah, the specific question, and I think you've touched on it without answering it specifically, is whether a non-Christian could further the goals of the kingdom of God on earth.
Yes, that's right. I couldn't remember that last point. Yes, I do think a non-Christian people, you know, this document in Vatican Council II was contrarily titled, different from all the rest. Most of the rest, if you read the introductions, they begin with those Latin words and so on. The introduction is always to our brothers of the episcopacy, to our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. That one was addressed to all people of goodwill. And we do believe, and that is a basically optimistic document, I realize, it has not an emphasis on the fall, and while we are with you all the way on original sin and all the rest, it is basically an optimistic document, and I believe if you look at the world today, there are many, many marvelous works, and we believe that these are also through the finger of God, marvelous works of justice and of peace and development done by people who do not know Christ. We believe that God works through all people of goodwill.
Pamela Schaefer, happy to have you with us.
Thank you very much. If I may, as an outsider, ask a question. Archbishop May, you talked about the need to shape a consensus in order for the church to be a witness in the world. And today in the news, there was kind of a startling story about the Catholic bishops hiring a public relations firm to shape public opinion on abortion at the tune of, I think, about $1 million a year, which strikes me as a real interesting new development in the church's efforts to shape public opinion. Just wonder if you would comment on that. Also, I wonder, does this signify some kind of failure on the part of bishops and pastors to be able to shape public opinion in traditional ways?
I think, first of all, I haven't seen the article to which you refer, but I know there is, under Cardinal O'Connor of New York, who operates in a New York kind of way, and who... and who is the chairman, presently, of the Pro-Life Committee of the U.S. Catholic Conference. There is an attempt to do that, and he reviewed it with the bishops at the administrative board, and they expressed their confidence in his efforts. Number two, is that a proper way? I think that hinges into the previous question. Anything that will develop the common good and will achieve some kind of justice and some kind of good for the most innocent and helpless members of society and human life, anything that is not in any way intrinsically immoral can be used. There's nothing wrong with that. Is it a failure? Is it a failure of the bishops? Yes, we're obviously failing in this country, and you are too in the Missouri Synod. We're all failing in developing in the minds of people a moral conscience with regard to this. This was touched on by other speakers today very clearly. Yes, we're all failing.
Dr. Robbie, please.
But am I correctly understanding you that the Catholic position now since Vatican II is that no longer is the Caesar under Rome by divine right, but that now Rome and Caesar are distinct? Is that what Vatican II did? It took Caesar away from the authority of Rome? Am I understanding that correctly?
Good. Well, the theology, of course, as you know, with Henry IV at Canossa and all the rest of it, was that Caesar indeed was under the authority of the church. All things in that medieval concept were under the authority of Christ, the great king and all kingdoms were under his kingship, and so on. That was their concept. Today we recognize that the church in certain whole areas, tremendous areas, has no direct authority. Its authority is, as I said before, to shape the minds and hearts of people, but also to challenge and to inspire people and to invigorate people with the good news of Christ to take their active role in the work of Caesar. And so the church doesn't cross off Caesar and abandon Caesar and say, we have nothing to say to you, but it calls on the church more and more to play its role in bringing the truth of the gospel to Caesar, but not any longer through the means that were considered legitimate, such things as excommunicating emperors. You know, it did that with Henry VIII. It did that in many kingdoms. Of course, it never worked. But it continued to exert that authority. Now, the church wants its independence. And that's why some people were quite upset and confused, more than upset, by the church having a Vatican embassy for Noriega to run to in Panama. Why is a church, the kingdom of the Lord here on earth, why is it having this kind of political means? Well, from the Middle Ages on, the church realized it could not either be under Caesar. And so it developed what are known historically as the Papal States, in order that it might be free, that it would not be under the thumb of the Italian princelings up and down the peninsula. And when the Papal States were taken away by Garibaldi and Risorgimento, what was left was a golf course size piece of land called Vatican State. And I'm getting away from the point, but the church always strives for freedom from the state, that it might do its work, not that it might exert the power of the state or over the state, but it wants freedom to be the church. And that's why it clings to and insists on its status in Vatican State, with that independence. And that's why, again, it accepts with great joy the American principle of separation of church and state, understood properly in the First Amendment, which gives the church that freedom and which keeps the church from trying to exert that authority over the state. That's a long answer.
Permit one follow-up.
So, in other words, Caesar's not under the church and the church is not under Caesar. And as I understand it, that's pretty close to the Lutheran doctrine of two kingdoms.
Well, if that's what you mean by the two kingdoms, it's not as strange as I thought. I think we found out in the Lutheran Catholic dialogues around the country, and today we found out from much of what was said by the three previous speakers today, that we are very close in many, many things.
It appears that we're going to have a child care legislation that will allow vouchers or credits to flow to Catholics, Jews, all Lutherans, all denominations. My question is, do you think that as we grapple with the education problems in the 90s, and if we move to a system of vouchers, what is the church's position on that? What should be a Christian politician's position on the issue of vouchers, and what are the pro and cons in terms of independence?
What we're talking about thus far in the Congress is for child care only, vouchers, in which a parent will receive, either through a tax credit or through actual funding, money in which it can provide child care for its child. Now, the parent can then choose if it wants to go to a non-denominational child care center or to a religiously sponsored one. It's free to do either one. If that's all you mean, that's fine. I'm all for that, and I think that's the American way. If it goes farther than that, what you're indicating is the voucher plan would then be the so-called choice in education. That is rising all around the country. And this is becoming, you know, an issue because the public schools are very, very fearful of it. You and we are kind of in this boat because of our parochial school systems. And if you're asking me personally, if you're asking where the Conference of Bishops stands, we certainly don't see any problem constitutionally at all in that regard. It's the practice in almost all the free world, in all the nations of the world, from Canada through Germany or Holland or France, Great Britain, Protestant nations, Sweden, Norway, all the nations of the free world follow some similar kind of arrangement. And I see it as no problem. It wouldn't be any problem for this country either, but it's going to be one horrendous battle, I can tell you that, with the entrenched power of public education.
Archbishop May, is the devil winning the war?
Are you quoting Cardinal O'Connor again?
No, no. No, I'm not. You have laid it upon us, and I'm not being critical when I say that. The politician is laying it on us. We are not doing enough. What about the causes of misbehavior, lack of responsibility in millions of American people who are taking it to us, giving it the responsibility to us? How do we compare with, let's say, 50 or 100 years ago in morals in this country as against today?
You can look at that in two ways. First, is the devil winning the war in the world today? No, I think we're winning the war. I think the world is in far better shape than it was, did you say 50 years ago? Oh, far better shape. If you look at the rise of liberty and of basic human values and all the rest in the nations of the world, we have terrible conditions in many places. But on the whole, I believe Christians should be optimistic at this time. There's an old Chinese curse which says, may you live in interesting times. I think these times are very difficult, but they hold out to us tremendous potential, tremendous opportunity for the whole world. Now, here in the United States, are our values better than they were 50 years ago? That's a different question. That was partly what I was indicating in quoting some of the people with regard to governance in the United States. While the rest of the world has caught our vision and caught our hope and looks for something like the American way and so on, in the United States, we seem again and again to be losing our vision and losing our values and so often giving up.
Referring to those, I was referring to the people who are causing our problems by their behavior, misbehavior, and lack of responsibility, laying more and more of the load on those of us who try to be responsible. I wasn't talking about depression. I was talking about morals in the American culture.
Well, morals involve everything. And so often when we talk about morals, sometimes we are talking about sex, and about violence, but there's a lot more involved in morals, of course. But yes, what I indicated to you before was that in many areas in the United States culture, our culture, the devil is doing a pretty good job on us. Mm-hmm. That's right.
If we are all very much desirous of Christians being in politics, I think we all agree that this should be done, that that kind of activity should be encouraged. Why did the Holy Father discourage Father Dylan from taking office? And then related to that, a question, when would a situation prevail where a Christian in politics would be eligible for excommunication?
I think in answer to your first question, the same principle holds as we heard from Pastor Liefeld this morning. It has been the tradition in this country particularly, but all over the world, but especially in this country, it has been the tradition of clergy to stay out of partisan politics, Catholic clergy I'm talking about. The last man in Congress before Father Drinan, whom you mentioned, was Richard, Gabriel Richard, in 1823. He came from the territory of Michigan because at that time they didn't have statehood. But he served in Congress for a very short time, the only priest who ever did such a thing. And then Father Drinan, who was at that time head of the law school at Georgetown, I believe, he ran for Congress from Massachusetts and served one term, and then the Pope said, that's it. He did the same thing with those priests who were part of the government in Nicaragua, you remember. And that is very close to what was presented this morning, the role of a pastor. A pastor should not be involved as a partisan politician in our tradition. He is to present the good news. He is to challenge and prepare people. The role of the layman in society is, again, a big part of the teaching of Vatican II, the priesthood of all believers. Priests should not be taking over the role of lay people, nor should lay people be taking over the role of the priest. That was your first question. What was the second? I'm sorry. Okay. But that's true around the world, see, because we are a world church. And as you know, we've had priests. You know Talleyrand, and we've had all kind of priests who tried to do that, figured, get a priest in there, they'll straighten out the government. They usually were just, torn apart.
Well, the second question was a build-up on the previous one, in that a Christian now active in politics.
Oh, yeah.
When does he, by failure of action or by action, become eligible for excommunication?
Yes. I don't know. The last one I can remember was in Louisiana, in Plaquemines Parish. I even forget his name, but Cardinal Cody at that time considered it a grave moral issue to insist on racial segregation in that culture, in that community. And this was an outstanding so-called Catholic politician who was head of the parish there, civil parish, Plaquemines Parish. And he would not invoke the law at that time for civil rights. And he insisted and maintained strict segregation racially. And the cardinal felt that that was a scandal. It was public denial of his role as a politician to observe the law, and his role as a Catholic denying the teaching of the church at that time, and he excommunicated him. But later he was reconciled to the church, because that's the purpose of excommunication, is to bring someone to his senses and hope that then he will repent and come back. And ultimately, on his deathbed, he did. But that's the last one in the United States that I can remember. Practically never are politicians excommunicated. The church doesn't use that and doesn't act that way. Although now, someone mentioned the governor of New York, there are people in the pro-life community who are insisting that he be excommunicated and so on, which I think would be a terrible mistake. But the church doesn't do that much.
two short questions, please.
Toward the end of part one of your paper, you read a beautiful section, if I could paraphrase it, that the church would act as kind of a model of charity by which the world would judge its own behavior. It would strike me that sometimes that is in tension with, say, the church or your council of bishops making pronouncements which seem to receive a kind of a public backlash. Could you comment on that tension?
Well, I think the tension is always going to be there. I think we all sense the tension, don't we? If you take what is called a prophetic stance, of course, only the prophetic people consider it prophetic. But everybody else considers it meddling, as they say down south. The preacher has stopped preaching and gone to meddling, they say. But anyway, it's a countercultural stance, and we have to face it. The gospel is countercultural in most of our culture. When it comes to family life, when it comes to this matter of pro-life, when it comes to honesty in government, when it comes to all kinds of things, we are up against a countercultural thing, and there's going to be a lot of tension. But if the church doesn't ever get involved in tension and doesn't ever engage that tension, doesn't ever oppose it frontally and directly, what does Jesus say about that? You know, Jesus was involved in tension all his life, and that's why he died, because he kept speaking to the authorities, both ecclesiastical and civil. And Jesus was a man who spoke constantly in the face of tension and opposition, and he continued to preach the word.
You mentioned Central America a couple of times in the realm of those moral issues which the church would want to address and has been addressing, and I know that both the Catholic Church and certain elements within the Lutheran Church, notably the ELCA as opposed to the LCMS, has addressed that in the area of justice, the whole justice issue. And certainly, and those groups, both Catholic and those Lutherans, have claimed the biblical mandate for doing so, and I would agree that the biblical mandate for justice per se, but it seems that what is pursued is not justice in general, but a particular type or brand which may or may not be biblically justifiable, or let me put it this way, that it can be claimed that that specifically is the right moral model as opposed to something else. And how this has come down, my understanding of it is that these groups, as I've mentioned, particularly within the Catholic Church, the Mary Knowlers, which it's no secret had a strong influence on Tip O'Neill and therefore on Democratic Party policy in Central America for a period of time there, basically opposed our support of the Contras in Nicaragua and our support of the government in El Salvador. And then it seemed that in so doing that they were supporting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and supporting the rebels in El Salvador in the name, again, of peace, freedom, justice, and so on, even though neither of those groups they were supporting were particularly friendly to democracy, with the Sandinistas practicing censorship, stifling of the freedoms of opposition parties, and so on. And yet this was evidently the biblical moral thing to do, was to support that group as opposed to another group in that country. And likewise, even though the government in El Salvador did have free elections, and it's also interesting, I read an article regarding the latest elections in Nicaragua that, oh yes, those are free elections, but of course it still wasn't accurate because the U.S. was giving financial support to the opposition party, which won out over the Sandinistas. And I just wonder if we can really say that there was a biblical mandate there, because it seems that the peace and freedom and justice being supported tended to be of a particular type, and it was rather selective and arbitrary, if you see what I mean, and it seemed to be that of going with the left wing as opposed to the right wing, as opposed to going with peace and justice rather than oppression and dictatorship and so on. And what I'm trying to say, quite simply, trying to get there, you know, is that can we honestly claim to have the Bible or a biblical mandate as our authority when we're seeming to be taking such a segmented a view there? That's my question.
We have one minute.
1 minute.
According to the clock, I have 1 minute.
Yeah.
You have asked, obviously, a very, very multifaceted, multifaceted question. You know, you're talking about history. You're talking about a social situation with 90% of the property in the hands of 8 or 10 families, you know, all that kind of background. I would just ask you, you know, when you look at this, to remember, though, that there was not this monolithic attitude of Catholic Church. It was, you've oversimplified. As you know, in Nicaragua, the Cardinal Obando Bravo has been extremely forceful in denouncing the Sandinistas and so on. On the other hand, you have in Salvador, you've had about 70,000 people killed. The latest are the 6 Jesuits and the 2 women, poor serving women who worked with them. These people are all killed. Did you see Romero, the movie? It's 10 years ago that Archbishop Romero was killed, not organizing guerrillas. He was saying mass, shot through the heart. When you see that, there has never been one person in Salvador brought to justice for any one of those killings. Not one. And this latest one, there'll never be a conviction. That is the government which, whether it's elected or not, is beside the point. That government is running that kind of regime. And these people are all dead, their families and so on. All these people, not because they were fighting. They're not members of the guerrillas. These are helpless, non-combatant, civilian people. Mostly ordinary working class people. Now, a few have spoken for these poor people who have no one to speak for them. And usually it's been the clergy have spoken. And as you know, the Lutheran bishop at the time of the killing of the priests had to get out of the country. He was threatened. He would have been dead also, and so on. When all these things go on, and it's now, you know, years and years and years, and the killing continues, and we continue as the United States to supply all the military plus financial support for that government. And all they ask is don't send any military means. Keep the arms away, and the killing might stop. But we continue to do it. And it's a very complicated, and I realize it's oversimplification to try to answer a question like this in 2 minutes. But I think everybody has to see the tragic picture of what goes on there.
I'm afraid we're going to have to, since you had asked one question before, I hope you'll understand. For the benefit of those who are going to the banquet today, we'll have to cut it off. And don't forget, 5:45 is the reception, and 6:30 the banquet hour. Again, our kind thanks to you, Archbishop May. We're very grateful to you for your...